previously.
You know, most people think, hey, this is easy. I'm going to stop taking my pills and, you know, we'll start having sex every other day mid-cycle. And, you know, lo and behold, it'll happen in a month. But in fact, that's really not always the case, which is why the whole show is here and why the, you know, infertility practice is here. But
this is Beyond the Birds and Bees on Austin's Talk 1370.
Good afternoon. I'm Dr. Thomas Vaughn from the Texas Fertility Center with one of my partners, Dr. Rinku Mehta. And welcome on this afternoon. It is very windy out there, just as they predicted. That's actually not a bad job being a weatherman, Snoop. What do you think? I mean, you can be wrong and still keep your job. As physicians, we can't do that.
But anyway,
but anyway, we welcome you to our Talk Radio 1370. Our show is Beyond the Birds and the Bees. And today, we're actually going to talk about in vitro fertilization. But before we get into that, Rinku, tell us what's coming up for educational opportunities in the group.
We actually have several seminars coming up. You know, there's a lot of information on our website as well, which is www.txfertility.com. And for general infertility, we have a seminar coming up next week on December the 15th called the Maybe Baby Seminar. This is at St. David's Round Rock Medical Center, and it's at 6 p.m. on December 15th. If you'd like to reserve a spot, you can simply call our office at 451-0149 or go to our website, and there is an email link where you can go ahead and RSVP for the seminar. It is a free seminar. There are refreshments and a lot of very helpful information. And then next, today's show, we're going to be focusing on in vitro fertilization, as Dr. Vaughn mentioned. And on January 11th is our next IVF seminar, which is a lot of information with all the details relating to in vitro fertilization. We also have some cool videos that you can see about the process. And that, again, is on January the 11th at 6:30 p.m. at North Austin Medical Center. And information on that can also be found on our website. A good place to go when you visit www.txfertility.com is go to our event calendar, and all our upcoming events are listed on there.
Well, that's just great. We really try our best to get as much information out as we can so everyone can understand more about causes and treatments for infertility, because it can be a very frustrating problem to have for a young couple. You kind of grow up thinking, if you have intercourse, you're going to get pregnant. And in fact, our parents probably scared us appropriately to say, don't you do that. And so that when you get to this point and you can't get pregnant, it's kind of a real shocker. And I think in particular, couples will put this off for a period of time and then find out that actually the age of the woman can be a real problem if you put it off too long.
Now, you know, a lot of couples put off even seeking evaluation, because there is a big misconception out there that in vitro fertilization is extremely expensive, and when somebody's infertile, that's their only option. You know, people come in and to our office and say, oh, well, you know, we thought it cost like, you know, $25,000 to do a cycle of in vitro, which is so not true. It is significantly cheaper than that. And also, I've had couples who have thought infertility is not affordable and have gone the adoption route. And that actually is more expensive than fertility treatment. So I always tell people that before you make any decision, you always want to, you know, make sure you have all the information that you need. And in vitro is a great treatment for a lot of people.
You know, it's kind of interesting, too, because everyone's perception, or a lot of people's perception is that everyone will need in vitro. In fact, I've had patients say, you know, we didn't come in because we didn't know, we didn't think we needed IVF, but we actually offer even first day treatment and evaluation for infertility. And we feel that anyone who's been sexually active for a year without contraception and is not conceived under the age of 35 or 6 months over the age of 35 really should seek help.
Absolutely.
They should have conceived by then, and it may not be a big problem. It may be easily correctable, but it's better to figure out what the problem is, get it treated, and kind of get that resolved.
Right. And once you have the information, really the ball is in your court. There's no mandate that you have to do treatment if you don't feel that it's right for you. You can always say, you know what, I know where I stand and I don't want to proceed. But in that subset of couples that simpler fertility treatments does not work and they have to go to in vitro fertilization, you know, there's it's quite a, you know, detailed and very scientific process. It was first, the first baby was born, what, about 30 years ago with in vitro?
Yep.
And it's a very progressive field. We are so far ahead now compared to 30 years ago as far as our pregnancy rates and the things that we've learned. And Dr. Vaughn was one of the first people in Texas to do in vitro fertilization. So I would be really interested to hear your perspective on how things have changed and what you've seen over the years.
Boy, really, hasn't it changed? We began the program in Austin in 1983. It took us a year to set up everything. The first retrieval was 1984. And we had one pregnancy, but unfortunately she miscarried. The following year, that actually was the fall of 1984, so it's just 3 months. The following year, we had pregnancies that resulted in live births. And it's kind of interesting, in that year and the following year, our pregnancy rate was 9 to 10%. And we really thought that was great because the national average was only 8%. Boy, has it changed now. I mean, the chance of getting pregnant is certainly around 50% if you take all ages, and in really younger women, it is even higher than that. But there's been many changes, and most of it has been in the ability of the laboratory to mimic the environment of the fallopian tube where an egg is fertilized by a sperm and is nurtured to grow and develop and then eventually transported into the uterus. And I think that's where the real changes have come.
Right. You know, the technology, the science behind how do you grow an embryo outside the human body to make it develop and mimic natural conditions has really progressed a long way. And as Dr. Vaughn says, pregnancy rates, you know, for instance, for egg donors who are young women in their 20s are now approaching 80-85%. And that's huge compared to 8 or 9%, you know, 30 years ago. And other big change that we've had in laboratory technology is the availability of ICSI, which is intracytoplasmic sperm injection. You know, about maybe, 15 years ago even, we didn't have this technology, and men with very, very poor sperm counts, even in vitro fertilization, was not able to overcome that hurdle. So, Dr. Vaughn, how have you seen ICSI?
It's been a great, great evolution of helping men with low sperm counts. In general, it was felt that if guys had, well, first off, a normal sperm count is like 20 million sperm per cc of volume of semen. And when guys got below 5 million, it just really didn't work. And so these couples were faced with adoption or donor sperm or something like that, rather than having the ability to help fertilization occur. We have now gone so far with the techniques that a couple years ago, we actually had a patient who had 12 eggs, and her husband had 8 sperm. That was it, just 8, not 8,000, not 8 million, 8, and actually 4 embryos and pregnant, but unfortunately miscarried. So we know we can achieve fertilization with very, very low sperm counts, and pregnancy rates have been really good.
Yeah, and for that case, our laboratory, you know, we have dedicated embryologists. They had to scan the sperm specimen for hours to find those, you know, 8 sperm. But we, you know, the laboratory is now equipped with microscopes that can help do that. And the specimen can be scanned so we can find exactly what we need. So we've definitely come a long way as far as male factor goes.
That's been really one of the biggest advances that we've had, in addition to having the media, that is the liquid that the embryo grows in, to have it more and more refined. And it should be no surprise that the best solution of salts and proteins and all of that would be exactly what the fallopian tube is, because that's the same environment. And what we really used in the early days was the solution similar to what they did in the cattle industry for growing embryos, cattle embryos in the lab. And then now with progression, we can see that what this the content is of the fallopian tube and replicate that, then we have a better chance to have growth. And it changes from day to day. So we actually have sequential media to grow embryos from day to day. And I think that's a really important part to. We're up against a break right now, so we're going to take just a couple of minutes and come back and talk a little bit more about that laboratory component, which is so important, and also talk a little bit about who's really a candidate for it, because most couples do not need in vitro fertilization to achieve pregnancies. So we're Talk Radio 1370, txfertility.com, and we'll see you on the other side of the break.
Hello and welcome back. This is Dr. Rinku Mehta, and my co-host today is Dr. Thomas Vaughn. We are of Texas Fertility Center here in Austin. And the number to call into the show is 390-1370. On our show today, we are talking about in vitro fertilization. And if at any point you have questions, please feel free to give us a call. Again, the number is 390-1370. So in the last segment, we started talking a little bit about the laboratory side of in vitro fertilization and who are the couples who end up needing in vitro fertilization. We talked a little bit about sperm and, you know, pregnancy rates. And, you know, we would like to think as doctors that that we're the ones that, you know, make the pregnancy rate so much better. But really, we can't do anything we do without the help of the laboratory. And that is one of the key components. And Dr. Vaughn, can you elaborate a little bit more about what happens in the laboratory during an IVF cycle?
Certainly. And we have six embryologists. That's how important it is to have an adequate team to take care of the patients that we take care of. And so really what happens is that when we retrieve or remove the eggs from the ovary, which is almost like drawing blood out of your arm, it's with a needle, the woman is sedated so she feels no pain, and those eggs are then delivered to the lab. They're in fluid, so the embryologist pick the eggs out of the fluid. The patient's partner has provided a sperm, a semen specimen for us to have sperm. That's being processed in a different part of the lab. And eventually the sperm and egg are put together and allowed to have a date, really. And you check the next morning to see if fertilization has occurred. They're moved to a different media the following day because this was insemination media. And now we're going to go into a growth media. And they're actually not looked at again for a couple of days. And then on that day, which is what we call day three, we make a decision. Do we know which embryos are the winners to go ahead and put them back into the woman's uterus through the vagina, through the cervix with a little catheter, or do we let them grow two more days? And our pregnancy rates have been good, transferring on day three or five. What we think is it's appropriate to just pick the better day that fits the situation for the couple and for the embryos.
And it's amazing that, you know, with the great pregnancy rates now with improved culture medium and, what we know, we usually limit the number of embryos we transfer, especially in young women, to just one or two. And the American Society of Reproductive Medicine has strict guidelines about how many embryos to transfer depending on the quality, the age of the woman, how many cycles they've had previously. But in general, women under 35 have excellent prognosis. And Dr. Vaughn actually presented a paper at the ASRM meeting in Denver this year where we looked at our data about putting in one embryo versus two embryos in a subset of women under 35. And we found that the pregnancy rates were pretty much the same, but the twin rates were much higher when we put in two embryos. So now the push is towards trying to put in fewer embryos so that we avoid the complications of multiple gestation.
That's so true. And in that study group that we had over 2 years, the pregnancy rate was over 70%, whether you put in one or two. The multiple birth rate of putting in two was 55%, and occasionally we had a triplet. So even one divided into an identical twin. And for those that have not had babies, everyone may think it is kind of cool to have twins, but it is a lot of work. And the thing that concerns us the most is that these babies, being a little overcrowded in the uterus, may want to come out early. And coming out a little bit early is okay because the neonatal intensive care units are so good, but if they come out really early, then that can lead to prematurity and disabilities, and that's something you have to deal with for life. So we really have a strong push to limit the multiple birth rate. And I think there's a national goal, too, of trying to limit triplets to 2 or 3%, and I was just looking at the data for last year from us, and we were at 1.2%. So we're really doing a good job of limiting that higher order multiple.
Absolutely. One baby at a time is the goal. And sometimes it's hard to convince the patients of this, but, you know, that is the healthiest, safest thing both for the mother and the baby.
You know, it was kind of interesting. One of the physicians that refers to us had a patient come over, and she actually had triplets. And so he wrote us a letter. He said, did it ever occur to you guys that I would do much better in my practice if I had three women with one baby than one woman with three babies, which is really, really true. We understand that very well. And actually, that patient had only two embryos put in. She was older, which was an appropriate number to put in, and one divided into an identical twin. I don't want to scare anybody. That happens only 1% of the time. And we would expect to see these things because our program it involves about 600 retrievals a year. It's kind of a large program, so that's a lot of people. So we can talk about these little anecdotes here and there, but that's really not the norm to have that many babies.
Now, you know, we started talking about the laboratory and component of in vitro fertilization, but maybe let's backtrack and what about who needs in vitro fertilization? You know, there are many simpler treatments before somebody has to go to in vitro route. And in some cases, people need in vitro right away because of whatever condition that they have. So how do we determine who needs in vitro fertilization?
Yeah, you know, I think it's important to maybe take even one step back from that and have our audience realize that of the patients that walk through our door, probably only 25% or less really do in vitro fertilization. There's so many other things that can be offered. If a woman has endometriosis, that treating endometriosis may help them get pregnant. Maybe the guy's sperm count's a little bit low and just washing the sperm and inseminating the sperm helps them get pregnant. And sometimes women just don't ovulate, and all they need to take is medication. And there's pills and shots, and maybe just the pills will work. So there's a lot of things that can be offered, but you're exactly right about what you said. Some will walk in and it's clear they need in vitro fertilization. Those primarily are women who have blocked tubes. And again, to step back, the procedure of IVF was developed to replace the function of the fallopian tubes and primarily for women who had ectopic pregnancies or tubal pregnancies. And it was just to replace the function of that fallopian tube. We learned as we went along, hey, this works for women with endometriosis without blocked tubes, unexplained, guys with low sperm count. It worked for many other things. But yes, someone with blocked tubes, particularly if there's been an attempt to unblock them and it was unsuccessful, or maybe the guy's sperm count's so low that we know that intrauterine insemination, that's washing the sperm, concentrating it, put it in the uterus, will not be sufficient to help them achieve pregnancy.
Right. And even with blocked tubes, while we don't need tubes during in vitro fertilization, we're bypassing the tubes. If the blockage is distal and the tube is big and dilated and full of inflammatory fluid, it's called a hydrosalpinx. And those tubes actually can decrease the chance of getting pregnant, even with in vitro fertilization, by up to 30%. So those typically have to be surgically removed or at least occluded so that they don't negatively impact the success rates with an IVF cycle.
And let me just add to that. Distal means distal from the uterus. In other words, the tube's connected to the uterus, and the other end is near the fallopian tube to pick up an egg. So those women with blockage toward the ovary are the ones that can collect the fluid that can leak back into the uterus and interfere with an embryo implanting and or just wash out an embryo. Those blocked at the corneal area, that's the part of the tube that joins the uterus, really close to the uterus, that is not an issue for these patients going through in vitro fertilization. But that is so true. And, you know, it's interesting, even some women who have a one blocked tube that is really, really bad and the other one is okay or looks okay, and we know that it probably has some damage, but just either removing that tube or occluding it so the fluid can't leak back in the uterus actually improves the chances of getting pregnant from the other fallopian tube.
Absolutely. So, you know, let's just go over what happens in an IVF cycle. One of the things that patients often are taken aback with is a lot of cycles will initially start with birth control pills for about, you know, 2 to 3 weeks. And the reason for that is that the way the ovaries or the follicles, the way physiology works is every month there's one follicle selected to ovulate from the growing pool and the rest kind of degenerate. In vitro, we don't want just that one follicle to take off and everybody else get left behind. We're trying to grow multiple eggs. So with the use of the birth control pills, we kind of shut down the body's own hormonal axis, and we're trying to get all the follicles at the same sort of level playing field so that not just one takes off, but we have a confluent growth of the eggs, and we have a potential of retrieving several eggs.
That's real. That's really important, because you really do not want the one or two just to go out in front and almost dominate the follicular development. The pills help with that. A drug called Lupron helps with that, which is a medication that kind of turns off the pituitary gland so the brain isn't stimulating the ovary and gives us a little more control over ovarian function with a medication that stimulates the ovary. All of these to get the embryo growth more synchronous, more together, has been, that's one of those developments that occurred in the mid to late 80s that started improving the pregnancy rates too. So that's a real important issue. And I know that it's kind of strange. I see a new patient, she's going to do IVF. We know that for sure. She comes in, she's so excited, we send her home on a birth control pill. That doesn't sound right, does it? But there's good reason for it.
That's right. And then once the ovaries seem to have been adequately suppressed using the birth control pill and Lupron, we start the injectable hormones. And, you know, Hollywood kind of makes things very dramatic. They don't go in your bottom. It's a tiny little needle, just it's under the skin. Most people will take it around the skin of their belly button. It is a daily injection, but it's easy to self-administer. And there are serial ultrasounds probably every 3 days during that time frame. And most people take about 10 days or so of stimulation before they're ready. And after which they have the egg retrieval that Dr. Vaughn had already talked about. And then the eggs that are removed are sent to the laboratory, put together with the sperm, and then the growth of the embryos is monitored. And then either day 3 or day 5 after the removal of the eggs is when the embryos are put back in the uterus. And what happens to surplus embryos? Say if somebody did really well, what do we do with the extra embryos that were not placed back into the uterus?
Well, there's several options for patients, but one is actually they could throw them away, but we don't do that in our program. We cryopreserve them. We freeze them that if they're alive and growing to be used at another time. And other programs, you do actually have the option of discarding or giving them over to research and those sorts of things. Now, it's important to realize that even though we say we can't discard, we don't own the embryos. The embryos are owned by the couple. We are simply caretakers, and it's just that our program doesn't discard. But the patient comes and says she wants her embryos. She gets her embryos for whatever she chooses or whatever they choose to do with them. But what our goal is, in the spirit of this, is that if we have extra embryos, let's freeze them to be used at another time. Once you have a baby, you finish breastfeeding, you come back in a couple years, it's less expensive to actually go to the freezer, thaw one of those embryos out, and put it in the uterus for a sibling.
Right, and a frozen embryo transfer cycle is also a lot simpler as far as, you know, medication-wise, than going through an entire in vitro fertilization cycle again. And, of course, you know, the embryos do have to meet certain criteria to be able to be cryopreserved, because if they don't, if they are barely, you know, struggling and not of very high quality, they will not survive the freeze and thaw process. So those embryos are not cryopreserved, but every embryo that does meet the criteria is frozen for future use. Now, you know, once the embryo transfer is done, the pregnancy test is typically 9 to 11 days later, depending on if it was a day 3 or day 5 transfer. And then the medication that needs to be taken after the egg retrieval are just some simple pills like estrogen and a progesterone suppository. So the injectable phase really ends at the egg retrieval. So the cycle, while, you know, it can sound scary, it's really not as cumbersome as people may imagine.
That is very true. And whether you have a day 3 or day 5 transfer, a really easy way to remember is that exactly 2 weeks after the retrieval is when you do the pregnancy test. That's kind of the end of the cycle, whether you put them in on day 3 or day 5. So that's a real easy way to remember that. And it is true that the progesterone support is with a vaginal suppository or a gel. And in the old days, it used to be an intramuscular injection, which really was uncomfortable. It was in oil, and the oil didn't dissolve for a while, and women were using heating pads. But now we have alternatives to that that give us equal pregnancy rates. In fact, we took a year of our patients and looked at those that received an injection, those that received the gel, and found the pregnancy rates to be equal. That's when we made the conversion to the gel.
Well, let's take a quick break, and we'll return to our show in just a few minutes.
Talk 1370, the right choice for weekends.
I'm Dr. Thomas Vaughn with Dr. Rinku Mehta from the Texas Fertility Center, and we're Talk Radio 1370. Any questions, don't hesitate to call us at 390-1370. And our website is txfertility.com. We're really trying to do our best to get as much information out as we can about difficulty in conceiving and what's available. And that's why we encourage you to look at our website. We've been doing this midday noon show for a while, trying to get information out on the radio. And there's a couple seminars that are coming up. Rinku, can you tell us again about those two?
Yes. On December 15th, we have the Maybe Baby Seminar at 6 p.m. at St. David's Round Rock Medical Center. And on January 11th, we have our IVF seminar at the North Austin Medical Center, and that is at 6:30 p.m. If you visit our website and go to the event calendar, all the information you need regarding these seminars and how to RSVP is on that site.
Yes, please don't hesitate. Call our office, ask questions, whatever you would like to do. We'll be pleased to answer any questions that you may have. And we've been talking about in vitro fertilization. We've been talking more about the techniques that are involved so that patients are comfortable with what they're going through, like the egg retrieval. Maybe patients don't understand what that is, but if they've had a laparoscope before, which is really, really common to have done, this is like 1/5 to 1/10 the procedure to get eggs out compared to a laparoscopy. So it's really, it's a kind of a short procedure. There's a sedation for 20 minutes. The procedure is about 15 to 17 minutes long. And then we have the eggs and we can move forward with that. You know, one of the things, Rinku, that we've heard, and I hear from patients here and there, is that they're so worried that because this feels so unnatural, that maybe there would be an increased risk of having an abnormal baby. Do you hear that from your patients?
Yeah, you know, that is often a concern that people voice when we're discussing in vitro fertilization. And it's not just patients. Yesterday, I had lunch with a surgeon. And he said, well, you know, people who don't have babies naturally probably shouldn't. You guys are populating the world with babies that weren't meant to be. And I was just floored by that comment. And, you know, he might actually have been kidding, but I know that people out there, you know, have similar thoughts. And that's almost like saying, well, if someone has cancer, we don't need to cure it because that was just meant to be. And, you know, it's pretty much the same kind of philosophy when people have such opinions about fertility treatments. But essentially, you know, there have been actually many large-scale studies done, both in our country as well as in Australia and in Europe. And, you know, since IVF has been around for 30 years, we've been able to gather some good data. And the studies have not shown any decrease in IQ scores or developmental abilities of these children. We do know that many IVF babies tend to be of lower birth weight than naturally conceived babies. That may have something to do with multiple gestation and even maybe some effect of two embryos being put in. We don't know exactly, but we do know that they can have lower birth weight. But as far as developmental issues, that has not been found. And also, the risk of genetic abnormalities in an IVF baby is not any greater than in a naturally conceived baby. And the biggest factor that affects whether or not a baby is genetically abnormal is actually the age of the woman, because the older we get, the higher the genetic errors in the egg and higher the incidence of abnormalities such as Down syndrome.
Yes, if you look at the population in general, patients or couples who are conceiving naturally, the thought is that the chance of a birth defect, an abnormality, may be 2 to 3%. When you look at what we have all reported, this actually all programs are subpoenaed each year basically to report their data, and not only success rate, but outcome in terms of if there's any birth defects, et cetera, the incidence has been under 2%. Really more like 1.4 to 1.5%. So we're actually doing a little better. Now, you might say, well, that's a good way to avoid something just by doing IVF and not doing it naturally. That's really not the message here. We're just pleased that it's not higher. And we do realize that we have couples that are behaving better. For instance, they don't use drugs, they don't smoke, and those sorts of things. And that's helpful. Now, I don't want to confuse anyone. If a couple has a genetic abnormality, we actually can evaluate those embryos when they're in the laboratory to determine which ones are genetically normal and select those to transfer back and avoid a genetic abnormality. This is not just a kind of a shotgun approach, but someone who may have very specifically like Tay-Sachs disease or sickle cell anemia, those sorts of things where we can actually find that genetic abnormality in the embryo.
And this is, you know, such an important point because, you know, not only, you know, in vitro fertilization is helping couples that are infertile, but we also now have the technology of helping couples, as Dr. Vaughn said, who are carriers of a known abnormality that want to conceive but don't want to take a chance that it will pass along to their children. Especially one major one that comes to mind is Huntington's disease, which is a dominant genetic condition. And if somebody has that gene, they always get Huntington's disease, which is fatal and, you know, very has a lot of morbidity associated with it. So we actually now have the ability that these couples, instead of trying on their own, can go through in vitro fertilization. Once the embryos are formed, we can biopsy a cell from each of the embryos and test it for the mutation. And then only those embryos that are mutation free are placed back into the mother. And hopefully she gets pregnant and she can rest assured that this is probably going to be a baby that's free of Huntington's disease.
And with Huntington's, the incidence, the chance that this couple would have a baby with Huntington's is 50%. 50%, that's pretty high. If you think about things like sickle cell anemia and Tay-Sachs, that may be 25%, or cystic fibrosis is 25%, because that's considered autosomal recessive. Those are recessive genes, where Huntington's is a dominant gene. And the other thing, too, that we've looked at is that there is a way to determine if couples have recessive genes by doing a sputum test and analyzing the DNA. It sounds like CSI a little bit, but you're analyzing for recessive genes because if a couple, if they have, most of us will, or a lot of us, I should say, have recessive genes, but if it doesn't match up with our partner, then no one would ever know that. And if we do discover that a couple has a recessive gene, then there's a 25% chance they could have a baby with the disease and not just be a carrier. So this is one of the things that we offer couples before they get into fertility treatments to be evaluated to see if they have recessive genes. And if they do any of them match up?
That's correct. And the other thing that people or women have concerns about is, does this increase my risk of cancer, especially ovarian cancer? And the answer to that is really simply no. You know, there have been studies done that have never been shown to have an increased association of fertility medications with cancer. Now, we know that women who have never been pregnant before may have an increased risk of ovarian cancer than women who have been pregnant before, just simply for the reason that their ovaries have been, you know, being stimulated their entire life, as opposed to pregnancy suppresses them for a period of time. But the treatments in and of themselves do not increase this risk.
There was one study in the mid-90s that suggested that possibly medication could increase the risk of ovarian cancer, and a group of women that were being followed, I believe it was on the West Coast. And what they did is that they continued to follow these women longer, and that risk went away. And they almost proved that they were wrong when they reported it early. So we really have no data or studies that have shown an increased risk of cancer. Primarily, we're talking about ovarian cancer. And women who take these stimulating drugs, Gonal-F and Follistim and Breval and all of those, to help them increase the chance of getting pregnant. And the irony of this is that when there was a little bit of a fear, we knew if they never became pregnant, they may have an increased risk of cancer. But if they did become pregnant, you decrease it, but you're saying that a medication that would help them get pregnant would increase it, or getting pregnant would decrease it. So it was very confusing, but we're really glad they continue to look at that group of patients, the only study that suggested that there was a problem, and learned later there's no problem.
So, you know, in our entire show today, we've been talking a lot about, you know, what is IVF, who needs it, you know, only, you know, in our practice, at least probably just 25% or so of people end up needing IVF because there are simpler treatments for many couples that can be used. We talked about, you know, how it's not as expensive as people can think. It's not correlated with increased risk of genetically abnormal babies. And just right now, we talked about, you know, no risk of increased ovarian cancer. Also, this field is very, very progressive, and technology is constantly improving, and we're constantly learning. Dr. Vaughn, do you want to talk a little bit about what's now going on in the laboratory about how we can select a better embryo just by looking at the components of the media?
Well, there are, this is something, the components of the media, this is something that is coming along where you look at the fluid that the embryo is growing in and look at the metabolites, or the things that the embryo put off as it goes through its metabolic growth phase, and looking at these different things to try to identify the really good embryos to transfer back. Right now, the way that we look at identifying what we consider good embryos that grade well are looking at just what they look like. In other words, these cells, is there fragmentation in the embryo? Are the cells regular, irregular? Are they dividing at the right rate that we expect? Like on day three, we want them to be at least 6 cells and preferably around 8 cells. And if they're only 2 or 4 cells, we know that they're not growing well, so they're not very good embryos. But this is one of the other things that we're looking at, and actually are going to be involved in a study looking at this.
And we're really excited about this study because, you know, this information can potentially be very useful because sometimes, you know, a perfectly healthy, beautiful looking embryo doesn't implant. And why that is so, we don't know. Oftentimes, maybe those embryos were genetically abnormal. Even though they looked perfect, they had some genetic abnormalities that were underlying. So through more research, can we identify those embryos? Do these genetically abnormal embryos have different markers that they produce, a different genomic imprint that they give out that we can determine before implantation? So this is some very exciting research. Well, when I'm in the field 30 years, and maybe I can talk about how I've seen this progress.
Evolution, yes, that's for sure. I am sure we will have really, really major changes as we go forward. Everything continues to refine. And we shouldn't be too surprised if we just look back 30 years and see the differences in the automobile that you're driving and things like that, just the quality of building a house and the insulation and all these sorts of things. It just makes you realize that in medicine we expect to see the same kind of improvements and maybe even more because there's so much emphasis on it. And it's so important to our life, being healthy.
Absolutely. And, you know, the things that, you know, people can do, of course, to improve their fertility while they're in the pre-contemplative stages are stop smoking, limit alcohol, limit caffeine, watch out for weight. Obesity can certainly decrease chances of getting pregnant significantly. And as we talked about before, you know, if you're doing all of these things and under age 35, if not pregnant, after 1 year of trying, it's important to at least get evaluated. And women under over that age, after 6 months, because again, there are many things that can be caught early and treated early. The worst thing in the world is, you know, when we have somebody that's 43 years old who's been trying for the last, like, you know, 8 years, and we wish that they would have come in sooner. And a lot of times, it's not just the patient. Their primary care doctors or doctors saying, oh, just, you know, stop stressing and, you know, you'll get pregnant eventually. But time is not our friend as women when it comes to fertility. So if there's an issue, it's best to get evaluated sooner than later.
And despite the fact that even if women come in their mid-40s and they can't become pregnant, we have an excellent option of a donor egg for them, where pregnancy rates are approaching 80%, it's still, I think these couples would prefer to have come in earlier and maybe be able to utilize their own eggs. So I think it's important to really move along with this. In fact, if you look at the graph of conception by age, it starts dropping around 31 to 32. Now, it doesn't drop dramatically, but it's on the decline. So most of us would say if we were just taking care of 20, 25-year-olds just getting married, complete your family by 32. And some are not even wanting to start until 35 or 40, and for good reasons. They want to get an education, find the right guy. But remember, there's a price to be paid for delaying things, particularly if a couple gets married at 35 and say, we want a five-year honeymoon before we have a baby. Might want to rethink that.
Absolutely. And, you know, about the age, there is a common misconception where people will say, oh, well, I had an aunt that had a baby at 47. Well, that is the exception to the rule. You know, if you even go to the CDC website and they've done population studies, and you can see that the live birth rates past age 43 are less than 1%. So that is really profound data, less than 1% live birth rate. More people will get pregnant, but because of the high risk of miscarriage, the actual live birth is much lower. So again, you know, age is a very important component of fertility, and we would urge all women out there to start thinking about their fertility sooner than later so that they have the opportunity to conceiving with their own eggs as opposed to needing donor egg right away. Well,
you know, one thing I want to throw in too, Rinku, is that's so important. The pregnancy rate is declining. And you made a really good statement about live birth rate. Well, what happens is not only is the pregnancy rate declining, but once a woman becomes pregnant, her chance of miscarrying is increasing. So they get a compounding negative effect there. And, of course, the result is that live birth rate, which can be so low. And when we see people that get on television and they're from Hollywood and they said, yes, I had twins at 50, and they want to say it's their own eggs, we're going, that's not true.
Right.
That's not true. So don't be fooled by these sorts of stories that you see in the newspaper and in magazines. Almost for sure that lady was using a donor egg.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for joining us on our show today. This is Dr. Rinku Mehta, and my co-host was Dr. Thomas Wan. We hope that you will join us next week, same time, noon to 1, for Beyond the Birds and Bees with Texas Fertility Center.
Talk 1370, the right choice for weekends.